We are in the book of Numbers, chapter number 11, and we are ready now to leave Mount Sinai and make our way to the Promised Land. At least that was the original intention. That was the original itinerary. We're going to have a problem along the way, and the problems will arise very quickly. But let's go ahead and read about the actual day of departure. It says, in the second year, in the second month, on the 20th day of the month. So we know all of that information can be plugged in to astronomy programs and things like that. And I think we're talking about it being on a Tuesday night after sunset on the 6th of June, 1455 BC. Because remember, Jewish days start at sunset. So in the second year, on the second month, on the 20th day of the month, the cloud lifted from over the tabernacle of the testimony. Now, this was the signal that we'd been told about in another passage, that Israel should get ready to move out. Now, because the day starts after sunset, the lifting up of that burning cloud by night would let everybody know, hey, tomorrow we're leaving. Tomorrow we're marching from this place. And so everyone would have started doing their initial packing on this particular evening after the cloud moved. So the people of Israel set out by stages from the wilderness of Sinai. And what will happen is they will move from one Sabbath encampment place to another. That seems to be the situation. We have all of these long-term encampment sites where the tabernacle is set up listed in Numbers chapter 33. But we know that there were more overnights than just the list that's there. So the camping sites in 33 of Numbers seem to be the ones where the tabernacle was officially set up. And I believe in this shorter period of time that we're looking at, in Numbers 11, that it's where the tabernacle was set up for a Sabbath rest period. Back to Numbers chapter 10, verse 12. The clouds settled down in the wilderness of Paran. We'll get to that later. That's the next longer-term encampment site. They set out for the first time at the command of He Who Is by Moses. The trumpets that we talked about last session, they're going to be used to let the individual tribal camps know when it's their turn to join the order of march. And remember that they're all in a circle around the tabernacle building with the Levitical tribes or the Levitical sub-tribes and the priest tribe right around the tabernacle itself. And this is the way that the march happens. Verse 14, the standard of the camp of the people of Judah set out first by their companies. And over their company was Nahshon, the son of Amminadab. So Judah tribe is encamped immediately east of the high priest and priest tribal encampment, which is immediately east of the front door of the tabernacle. And the Judah tribe is in charge of all of the tribes on the east side. That would be Issachar and Zebulun, which will be mentioned here in a moment. So they are the head. They are the leaders. They will follow the column of God's glory along the road. And so they're the first ones that start the march. And Nashon, the reason I highlight him from the text is because he is the direct ancestor of David, and he's also therefore the direct ancestor of Jesus. Now they are accompanied by the tribe of Issachar and the tribe of Zebulun. And so those three tribes together head out. Now verse 17 tells us that around this same time, that's when the tabernacle is being taken down. So when the tabernacle is taken down, the sons of Merari, the sons of Gershon and the sons of Merari who carried the tabernacle, they also set out. And then we've got the standard of the camp of Reuben, who is in charge of not just his tribe on the south side, but also the Simeon tribe and the Gad tribe. And so they head out. Then we have the Kohathites, verse 21. They set out carrying the holy things. And so now we've got not just simply the tabernacle itself on the road, but we've got the Ark of the Covenant and the table and the basin and the altar of incense, the altar of sacrifice, and the menorah. Those are all moving along as well. And then we have the tribe on the backside, the west side. It says, verse number 22, the standard of the camp of the people of Ephraim set out by their companies. So that's the head tribe of the three back there. The other two are Benjamin and Manasseh. And then verse 25, the standard of the camp of the people of Dan, acting as the rear guard of all the camps set out by their companies. And of course, they were camped on the north side. It was Dan in the center with Asher and Naphtali. And they're the tail end, Charlie. They're the rear guard for this march to the next permanent, or not permanent, but longer term encampment where the tabernacle will be set up. But they've got a couple of other overnights before they get to the next place. Now, we have a little bit of information here about Moses' brother-in-law. Verse 29, Moses said to Hobab, the son of Reuel, the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law. So Reuel is Jethro. Reuel seems to be his title as the priest of Midian. Reu has to do with shepherd. El is God, the shepherd of God. So apparently, when Reuel came at the beginning of Israel being at Mount Sinai, about a year ago, Hobab came with him, or shortly after. When Reuel left, Hobab stuck around. And so now Moses invites his brother-in-law and his brother-in-law's family to come and join them. We are setting out for the place of which he who has said, I will give it to you. Come with us. We will do good to you, for he who is has promised good to Israel. So Moses offers the opportunity for his brother-in-law, whom he's known for 40 years, to become an associated family group within the nation of Israel. But Hobab's initial reaction is this. He says, I will not go. I will depart to my own land and to my kindred. He's going to go back to Midian, which is not very far from Mount Sinai. And he said, please do not leave us. You know where we should camp in the wilderness, and you will serve as eyes for us. So apparently Hobab knew the region north of Mount Sinai very well. And Moses says, you're the best guy for helping us make our way toward the promised land. Verse 32, if you do not go with us, whatever good he who is will do to us, If you do go with us, whatever good he who is will do to us, the same we will do to you. And it seems as if he did convince him to come along, because we'll find out later that descendants of this family group will be living as Bedouins inside the boundaries of the Promised Land. Verse 33. Now, this is the reason why I said that they don't always set up the tabernacle every single time they stop for the night. It says, so they set out from the mount of He Who Is 3 days' journey. So they don't set up the tabernacle the first night that they stop. They don't set it up the second night that they stop. They set it up on the third day, which is going to actually be the 22nd. So they set out, and the Ark of the Covenant of He Who Is went before them 3 days' journey to seek out a resting place for them. This is another one of the principles of the idea that God is the king of Israel. He is the encampment commander. Wherever his tower of glory settles down and stays overnight, that is where the tabernacle will next be set up. And my guess is that if they wake up in the morning and the column of God's glory is still in the exact same spot where it rested the night before, that would be to them the indication, this is where we're staying for a while. And so they would set the Ark of the Covenant right under that glory cloud and then set up the tabernacle appropriately all around it and then set up all their encampments according to the directives of where each tribe is supposed to be located. Verse 31, the cloud of He Who Is was over them by day whenever they set out from the camp. Now, whenever the ark set out, so beginning of each day during the travel time, Moses would say, arise, O He Who Is, let your enemies be scattered, let those who hate you flee before you. So just a way of acknowledging God is in control. God is the commander-in-chief. Where He goes, we follow, and He does the fighting for us. Now, when the glory cloud rested, like I described, then Moses would say, return, O He Who Is, to the 10,000s of Israel. And so this would then become at least an encampment for a few days where the tabernacle was set up. Now, as I already said, it was 3 days' travel time from Mount Sinai, where they took the tabernacle down, to the next place, which is going to actually be a place we'll call Kibroth Hattaava. It's the wilderness of Paran. It's 3 days' travel, but they have overnights at different places along the way. And apparently that first overnight was not a good one. Verse 1 of chapter number 11. The people complained in the hearing of He Who Is about their misfortunes. Now, wait a second. It's the first travel day after they left Mount Sinai, and they're already griping. They're already fighting amongst themselves. They're already complaining. And so God disciplines the encampment. When He Who Is heard it, His anger was kindled, and the fire of He Who Is burned among them and consumed some outlying parts of the camp. So some of the fringe people got singed by God's judgment. Now, I want to make some suggestions here based on what we know about human behavior. And that is, people who don't like to follow rules tend to live on the fringe of society. And so I would expect that a lot of the people that were not all that enamored with God being in charge were putting their tents at the very edge of Tent City. And so they are probably the ones that are doing the griping. And so they are the ones that got in trouble first. Now, what happens when people get in trouble? Good people who get in trouble tend to repent. They tend to confess, what I did was wrong. But people who tend toward rebellion complain about the punishment. Verse 2, then the people cried out to Moses. Moses prayed to He Who Is. The fire died down. So the name of that place was called Taberah, which is just Hebrew for burning, because the fire of He Who Is burned among them. So that seems to be happening on the first overnight stop. Then, verse 4, now the rabble that was among them. Rabble here seems to be a reference to the non-Israelis, ethnically speaking, who decided to leave Egypt with them. We know about that group. And by the way, they would probably be at the fringes of Tent City as well. The rabble that was among them had a strong craving. So they want something different to eat than what they've been eating. The people of Israel also wept again and said, oh, that we had meat to eat. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt that cost nothing. The cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, the garlic. But now our strength is dried up and there's nothing at all but this manna to look at. Now, before I make any substantive comments on that, may I make a tongue-in-cheek observation. It's never a good idea to critique the person who's making your meals, who's providing your food. And that is exactly what these guys are doing. It starts first amongst the non-Israeli rabble, but it soon spreads like an infection, which happens with griping and complaining in any group. It soon spreads to the ethnic Israelis, and pretty soon everyone is saying, we need food, we need meat, we need a better diet, because you know what? When we were in Egypt, we had fish for free. We had our little vegetable gardens. We had lots of delicious things to eat. For some reason, they've already forgotten that they were also slaves. And now they haven't forgotten. They are just being ingrates. They are being unthankful to God and complaining about the fact that He's providing food for them, but it ain't the food they want. And you can already tell this is not going to go anywhere good. We have a little reminder of the manna. Manna is Hebrew for what is it? The manna was like coriander seed, and I think that means its shape. It was like a little round ball. Its appearance was like that of bdellium, which probably has a reference to its consistency. Bdellium is, well, it's like it's a resin gum that comes out of plants. What would happen is each morning before the sun comes up, the dew is forming in little bitty bubbles on all the flat surfaces all around the encampment of God. And as the sun comes up, all of that dew dries up and becomes little flaky balls of manna. Manna, what is it? on all the flat surfaces around the encampment. And so the people went about at God's direction and gathered it. They were supposed to gather one day's ration for every person in their tent, except for on the sixth day of the week, in which case they get 2 days' rations. They ground it in handmills and beat it in mortars. So they treated it as if it were little kernels of grain. And they boiled it in pots. So they'd make kind of a mush from it sometimes, and made cakes of it. So they'd make it into bread of some sort. The taste of it was like the taste of cakes baked with oil. In another passage, I think it said like cakes baked with oil and a little bit of honey. So it had, well, it had a bready taste to it with a slight bit of sweetness, it would appear. When the dew fell upon the camp in the night, the manna fell with it. So that's what they're griping about, is they've been having to eat God's bread for almost a year, and they want something different. Now, Moses heard the people weeping throughout their clans, everyone at the door of his tent, and the anger of he who is blazed hotly, and Moses was displeased. So Moses now gets upset because of where he's at. He is caught between a bunch of ingrates and the God that he serves. And he knows what's coming. He knows that there's judgment coming. And Moses knows that his responsibility is to represent the people to God and God to the people. And he doesn't like being put on the hot seat. And it comes out. Do you remember I told you that when Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, showed up right after they arrived at Mount Sinai, Jethro, who was a priest of God, observed Moses spending every waking moment acting as intercessor for all the people and trying to also play arbiter and judge for all the people. And Jethro said, "You can't do that, son. If you do that, you're just going to wear yourself and the people out. Nothing good's going to come of it. This is what you need to do. You need to find some people that you can trust that believe in God's judgment, in God's righteousness, in God's standards. Then you teach them all of those standards, and then let them, at different levels, take care of the things. Hopefully things will be resolved at the lowest possible level. And then you end up with only the really tough things that those lower levels of judges can't handle." But apparently, a year ago, Moses heard his father-in-law's advice, but ignored it. Remember how I told you that? Here is where Moses has a near nervous breakdown because he didn't pay attention to what his father-in-law's wise advice was. So verse 11, Moses said to he who is, "Why have you dealt ill with your servant? Why have I not found favor in your sight that you lay the burden of all this people on me? Did I conceive all this people? Did I give them birth that you should say to them, 'Carry them in your bosom as a nurse carries a nursing child to the land that you swore to give to their fathers?'" So now understand, Moses is a real guy. He is a real person. And when real people, even out of their own bad choices, come under intense pressure, they will get angry, they will get upset, they will shift blame, they will make accusations, they will say things that they don't really believe down at their core, because they're venting all of that frustration. And that's what he's doing. "Why do I have to take care of these people? They're not my people. You're the one that told me to get them out of there. You're the one that said that they're going to go to their promised land. And then he gets to the point of the moment, verse 13. Where am I to get meat to give all this people? They're weeping to me and say, give us meat that we may eat. I'm not able to carry all this people alone. The burden is too heavy for me. If you're going to treat me like this, then just kill me at once. If I find favor in your sight, that I may not see my wretchedness. So that's why I say, this is Moses' near nervous breakdown. And when I teach Scripture, I try to be honest about the humanity of the characters, of the people, because they are real. Moses brought this on himself. All of us do that from time to time. We make bad choices, sometimes right in the face of good advice. And then when it all goes to pieces, we get all upset and frustrated, blame other people, when in fact, if we just listened earlier, we could have spared ourselves and other people sometimes a lot of trouble. And so God repeats to Moses as a directive, a divine directive this time, all of the advice that Jethro had given Moses nearly a year earlier. And this time, Moses will listen and things will go much better. But for the moment, as we're getting ready to wrap up today, you have to picture Moses on his worst day. He is saying to God, if you can't get me some help, then just kill me now and get it over with, because I can't stand this situation any longer. And so God says to Moses, gather for me 70 men of the elders of Israel. And so this is where God is going to shift from people getting the job of leadership because they're old to getting the job of leadership because they're wise.